Hey everyone, it's Wednesday, April 27th, 2022. Welcome to the Real Vision Daily Briefing. My name is Weston Nakamura, and I am joined once again today by Mr. Darius Dale, founder and CEO of 42 Macro. What's Darius, up, how are you, sir?
I'm doing well, man. You should have told me you were wearing a suit. I wouldn't have worn one myself, but I would have definitely known.
Suit. These are my pajamas. This is how I sleep.
So. You're always ready to go, man. Really appreciate you guys. You checking in on Japanese hours. I know it's tough.
I mean, it's global hours, right? So it's all global good. Hours. Now, you know, the last few times you and I get together, it's because Japan had blown up that day. However, this time is different. We might actually be front running a potential blowing up of Japan, or maybe not. The reason I'm saying that is because tomorrow, we have a BOJ, Bank of Japan Monetary Policy meeting, which is probably the first one that's been in focus in years. So we'll touch on that in a moment. For now, just taking a look at markets as we're kind of closing up here. It looks like U.S. indices for the most part ended up more or less flat on the day, giving up some incremental gains. Europe closed positive. In Asia, you had a reversal in the Chinese indices and Chinese stock markets to the upside. But again, this was following pretty severe sell-offs happening over the last several days, which we can get into as well. So, this is the pre-BOJ meeting day rather, and so we're going to touch on that. But Darius, I just want to talk to you about China.
Oh yeah,
because I know you've been certainly all over this. So market price action, we've seen, let's just start with the currency. The yuan had been getting just killed since really last Friday or so. We've been seeing like two consecutive days of 1% moves on USD CNY, which is huge for a managed currency. And like minus 3% over a 3-4 day span. Those are some very serious moves. So what are you seeing and then of course the equity indices too have been selling off, and then they had a sort of short squeeze rebound today on headlines of like sort of infrastructure from President Xi. So just give me your view on what you see happening in China right now.
Yeah, let's take a step back and kind of paint the picture for those who may be new to the Chinese economic situation. Obviously, the world's second largest economy, but not many investors sort of follow it with the same rigor, analytical rigor that they do the U.S. and other economies. So the Chinese economy has been cyclically slowing since the early part of 2021. They are sort of towards the tail end of their cyclical slowdown, at least according to our models. But by that admission, they're certainly in the lowest level of activity that we've seen. And part of the reason we're seeing such low levels of activity in China there is a function of their zero COVID policy. So they have the entire city of Shanghai more or less completely locked down right now. That's their largest city by GDP and population. Obviously, Beijing being one of the top three cities by GDP and population, they're actually rumored to potentially be ramping up testing that could potentially lead to a lockdown of Beijing. We're not there yet, but it's certainly an issue as it relates to the very near-term Chinese growth outlook. I mean, if we're talking about this 2-3 months later, I don't think any of this will be relevant anymore. But certainly, from a very near-term perspective, it's a big deal. And so, as a function of the Chinese growth sort of metrics, whether you look at hard data, whether you look at expectations, GDP estimates continue to get slashed across economist consensus, or whether you just look at it from a market standpoint, Shanghai Composite hit a 2-year low before rebounding this morning. The markets, the economists, and pretty much everyone out there understands that the growth outlook in China is very challenged. And so as a function of that, there have been a lot of calls from investors for the PBOC and for the Beijing, for Chinese fiscal authorities to ramp up stimulus. And there have been actually sort of rhetoric out of those entities in supporting some of those calls. You go back a few weeks ago, we had Li Keqiang come out and say they need to do more to step up policies to promote the stock market. Then, like a couple weeks after that, or a week after that, They push the the kind of the central Beijing, which is kind of the entity that owns all these sort of state assets in China, to buy more stocks, to buy more support Chinese asset markets, and also to send a signal to Chinese asset managers. And then most recently, this morning, we got President Xi Jinping out with a sort of pledge to promote to step up infrastructure investment to counter the growth slowdown, which ironically is partially his fault as a function of the COVID policy. And so we're here today trying to figure out what is the most likely outcome from a economic and more importantly, monetary and fiscal easing standpoint in China. So happy to unpack that.
Yeah. Let's actually just, address the kind of the policy steps before the actual, the policy steps he's taken before the kind of jawboning measures, if you will. But most recently what they did was, so I believe it was, correct me if I'm wrong, Darius, but it was 2 days ago or 3 days ago. But the official stepped in, and what they did in light of this falling yuan was that they raised the, they lowered the foreign exchange reserve ratio for banks by 1% down to 8%. Mm-hmm. That's starting in mid-May. And that is basically what that does is, it's to reduce like the requirements to hold domestic currency, and that should basically dampen the desire to hold foreign currency USD, for example. Mm-hmm. And therefore support the yuan, and that actually did have that market outcome that they had intended for. Now the kind of problem with that with doing that is that last year in 2021 the FX reserve ratio, this rate, they raised it twice, and at that time they did so by citing that they're trying to combat yuan strength, mm-hmm. and they were also saying at the time that yuan strength, that this is market forces driven. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, not anymore as of two days ago. So that goes against that. But I guess that's kind of like a hybrid between actual sort of policy implementation as well as some jawboning going on. But
let's take a step back. They did ease policy to a slight degree by the sort of yuan devaluation that we saw over the weekend. It was nothing to sort of write home about in terms of where we've been in historical yuan depreciation cycles, but it was a big pip move relative where we had been trending, certainly from a realized volatility perspective and also a levels perspective. We pretty much gapped up, let's call it from, just above 6 to 660 or just under 660 on the USD and USD CNY or USD CNH. And so that move you're discussing now was effectively to release capital to allow Chinese banks to sell dollars on behalf of their clients and sort of cap the, sort of put a floor under the depreciation cycle. And so it's my interpretation that the monetary authorities, the PBOC and the fiscal authority in China effectively did that sort of slight devaluation kind of as a shot across the bow to their sort of counterpart across the pond in Japan to say, hey, look, you continue to allow the yen to depreciate at this pace. It's going to have implications because we're going to do what we need to do to maintain our competitiveness. Obviously, Japan is probably China's number one principal sort of export competitor, if you will. And certainly the implications of the yuan. The reason we're having this discussion, by the way, is because historically we've seen going back to 2015, 2016 is kind of the most recent major example of yuan depreciation having a massive impact on global asset markets. And the reason it has a massive impact on global asset markets is because sometimes it can coincide with disinflation cycles. Brian, if you pull up that chart, yuan devaluations chart I sent you, you can kind of see what I mean. So there have been sort of three kind of yuan devaluation episodes. There have been six sort of disinflation episodes kind of since the global financial crisis in the U.S. and global economies. Three of them have coincided with, sort of managed depreciations in the Chinese yuan. And that makes sense, right? China's the world's largest sort of export or in terms of, import demand. China's the number one exporter to the U.S. at about 18% of total imports. It's the number one exporter to the EU at about 20% of total imports. So obviously the price of the yuan and what Chinese yuan goods are being priced in on a dollar swap basis clearly has an impact on the inflation cycle. So that's why a lot of investors were so very concerned about this, because a lot of folks would have been offsides being long kind of reflation or inflation, the two regimes associated with inflation accelerating in terms of those exposures. And a lot of folks are just simply not positioned for deflation or disinflation at this particular juncture. So we saw a lot of pain on Monday from a lot of different accounts.
Yeah. And, you know, it's just that, just to remind people, that August 2015 deval, that was huge.
That was nasty.
You know, that was cross asset volatility across the board. Mm-hmm. And it was just from, you know, really not that big of a devaluation, but basically it was the signal that was sent. And that's that kind of, you know, that kind of almost accidental firepower that they have. You know, what I mean by that is, it's almost like when they're trying to actually instill a policy or draw up on a policy in, or you know, a market desired outcome in, they find temporary success at best. On the other hand, when they use some of their monetary tools, they can, you know, they're basically bringing an axe to a, you know, like a surgery, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. A samurai blade to a surgery. I mean, that's been the history of Chinese monetary and fiscal policy responses to growth slowdowns. Brian, if you pull up that other chart I sent you on China 3-month Shibor versus the China credit impulse, you know, this is, you know, kind of let's set the stage, if you will, for why we're here today. So the reason China is sort of slow to this place, it's because the PBOC, the Chinese Beijing, the sort of state council has been unwilling to sort of do the broad-based, wide-scale, physical infrastructure style stimulus that we've become associated with in previous Chinese reflation cycles. I mean, if you go back and look at the kind of the last five big easing cycles we've seen in China, as denoted by the charts, the red dotted line, the blue dotted lines in those charts are kind of the beginning and end of those easing cycles. You know, right? If you compare it to today, you'll notice that, hey, look, we've hardly seen any easing in the Chinese financial sector, you know, kind of in recent months. You know, we've only seen a 25 basis point decline in 3-month Shibor year to date. The reason I track 3-month Shibor is because PBOC has a variety of tools that it uses to sort of control the cost of money and availability of credit in the Chinese financial sector. It's got open market operations, medium term lending, RRR, reserve requirement ratios, you know, different other ratios and loan prime rates, et cetera. So the 3-month Shibor, given that about 80-85% of all private non financial sector in China is on bank balance sheet, sort of more or less, you know, it captures all those, you know, kind of moving parts in totality. And historically speaking, when you've seen these sort of massive easing cycles in China, the kind you need to be afraid of as a bear, to be very clear, you typically have seen already kind of 200-300 basis points of easing in 3-month Shibor as a function of all those other moving parts. Well, we've only seen really 25 basis points of easing thus far, and it's certainly not enough, in our opinion, to get the Chinese economy meaningfully resuscitated in any kind of sort of, you know, systemic reflation that would sort of catalyze, you know, kind of a, you know, different outlook from a medium-term asset market response perspective.
We're going to take a quick break and be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PI, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know,
trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcasts, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Yeah. So what do you make of the fact that they kind of, you know, like, so take loan prime rate that they left unchanged, that they're not really doing anything in that realm, but I've never seen jawboning like this. I don't mean just from China, from anyone. Like, you know, you were talking about earlier, if this was a day of March FOMC when they just came out of nowhere And, you know, they basically just did this verbal intervention in the equity markets, like explicitly saying, foreign long only investors, add to your shareholdings. This is market bottom. And flipped on every single sort of thing that they had, every single cloud that was overhanging, you know, Chinese equity markets, be it the tech regulatory crackdown, the Evergrandes and the property sector deleveraging, all of that just kind of flipped on a dime. So they'll do that. But then actually, when it comes to the actual like policy, they're on hold. What do you make of those, like that kind of divergence?
So I mean, look, I think they're in a tough spot, right? Like they understand that, you know, they need to hit a certain level of growth target. Now we can debate what that should be and what it's likely to be. I think we have a good clip from my friend Leland Mill over at China Beige Book on that particular topic. You know, that number is coming down, and it's coming down sustainably over the long term. Now they don't need or want it to crash. It does no one any good in Beijing to have Chinese growth fall off a cliff. And so they're going to do and tinker whatever tools they can tinker with. The problem is, and this is what I was trying to say earlier, is that for whatever reason, in this particular growth slowdown that we're engaged in China, we have simply not seen the kind of response we've seen in previous growth slowdowns. Now, why is that? Maybe it's a tacit admission that, you know, China is sort of getting further and further, closer and closer to the brink of the abyss from a leverage cycle perspective, in the sense that it can no longer continue extending credit at the cost and at the supply to continue capitalizing, you know, what is very unproductive investment. It's proven to be unproductive investment. And if you look at Chinese inflation statistics, which I think, you know, the headline CPI is somewhere around 1.5%, core CPI is somewhere around 1.2%. You know, if you look at their inflation statistics, they look more like Japan than they do like most emerging market economies. And you can make the case that a lot of the sort of overbuilding of property supply, the overbuilding of manufacturing capacity that we've seen in the prior two and a half decades has really been something that's kind of weighing on the Chinese inflation and nominal growth in China. And so at the end of the day, I think they're well aware of the longer term implications of continuing to, you know, kind of, for lack of a better term, build empty cities, you know, build unproductive capacity from a manufacturing standpoint. And so I think they're reluctant to do that, which means they're just going to continue to do what they can to put a floor under growth and maybe kind of tilt it back towards the upside, but certainly not kind of do anything that would cause a kind of a reflationary boom across the global economy.
Yeah, indeed. So actually, you know, let's take a look at that clip of Leland Miller from China Beige Book CEO. This was a interview from 19th with Maggie Lake on the Plus and Pro tiers. So let's take a look at that clip.
But in China, they want to rule forever. So the party is much more focused on the structural problems in the economy in a way that Western analysts don't even pretend to understand. And so they are stepping in to change the economic growth model. They've changed it already. It's happening right now. All these growth projections about growth going down a tenth of a percentage point in 2025, it's nonsense. We're in a new regime, and we need to treat it like a new regime, and we need to have the expectations about China's role in the world and China's growth numbers that are concomitant with that understanding going forward.
All right, so that was Leland Miller and Maggie Lake. Leland Miller, once again, from the China Beige Book CEO. That airs on April 19th for the Plus and Pro tiers for Real Vision. So let me just now just kind of pivot over to Brian. If you put up chart three that I have, the reason that I'm talking about China, we're talking about China as it relates to the BOJ and the yen, this is just a chart of dollar yen and the 10-year U.S. Treasury yield, which we all know this chart. They basically mirror one another. And then as well as I also threw CNY JPY, so Chinese yuan yen cross rate. And that like sort of, you know, like peak that you see and then that kind of reversal and plummet, that peak point right there, that is when the Bank of Japan first announced their latest round of fixed rate operations, which have been running for, six consecutive days. And that basically ends those fixed rate operations to buy an unlimited amount of JGB 10s at a yield of 25 basis points. That ends as of today, later today, which is going to be BOJ Day, which is also the last trading day before Japan goes on a very long holiday and the world is absent the world's largest foreign capital allocator amidst all this. So we are in very interesting times ahead. Darius, what do you make of what's coming within, I guess, the next, 24, 48 hours, the BOJ meeting, basically, and the market response potential?
I mean, if they're going to change the yield curve control policy, they're doing it in the worst possible way. They certainly would do, they're doing it in the way that would create the most amount of financial market volatility and create the most destabilizing impact across global financial markets. So we have a view that they're not going to. I mean, we obviously got a pretty strong message from Governor Kuroda a couple times last week, actually, in terms of renewing their commitment to yield curve control. I mean, again, this just goes back to, it's not about what these people want to do. It's what they have to do. The inflation dynamics in Japan continue to be well shy of the Bank of Japan's target, and they continue to obviously have some very big struggles in terms of achieving those objectives. And so until they achieve the objectives, which at least according to our forecast over the next 12-month time horizon, they're not going to achieve their inflation target. And so they're very likely to maintain yield curve control unless there's some sort of political objective in Japan that comes down the pike that is, just very against, the speed and pace of the yen depreciation. But we put up a chart last week, we tweeted out, actually might have been 2 weeks ago, where we're showing the kind of relative volatility in the Japanese yen relative to prior intervention cycles. And we're nowhere near the kind of volatility we've seen on average in prior intervention cycles. So we continue to be pretty steadfast in our belief that, it's going to be mum's the word with respect to yield curve control and the yen depreciation that we're seeing in this cycle.
Yeah, so first of all, I got to applaud you again on that chart because it was awesome. But yeah, I mean, I was looking, oh, this is so simple. Why did I think of this? And I was like, oh, it's because then I remember.
Oh, no. I'm trying to keep up with you, man. Your chart's been killer.
But if you haven't seen that chart, I have it on my Twitter feed. But basically, what Darius basically tracked was just the historic moments in which there were yen intervention from top down policy, directed manner, and realized volatility of the yen. And the reason that we're looking at it from that angle is because we're not, the level of the yen in and of itself does not matter to policymakers, really doesn't even matter to that much to the corporates and the investors alike. It's the speed and the volatility and the sort of, the velocity of the move that's concerning. So that's why you're looking at realized vol. And we are very far off from those other historic times in which we did this, in which they did some, sort of intervention. I was on Twitter Spaces yesterday, or I guess about 24 hours ago or so, with Ash and with Jim Bianco discussing this. And, what I was saying, too, about yen devaluation is that, fine, there may come a time where that happens, right? But before that happens, it's of my view that the Japanese authorities, by which I mean the Ministry of Finance and not the Bank of Japan — Bank of Japan does not do the FX, it's not in their remit, FX intervention. That's the Ministry of Finance. But before they, intervene in currency, what you're likely going to see chronologically is you're going to probably see a dialing back of this actual severe intervention they're doing in the rate market, in the JGB market, totally. Rather than continue on with this extreme intervention in the JGB market and then also throw on an additional, intervention in the currency market. They're probably going to dial it back first before they, before they go there with intervening with the yen. And if and when or should that day come, it's going to be a very globally coordinated sort of thing. It's not just going to be something that they just do under the table. They're going to have to get their G5, counterparties together. And it's going to be something that everybody recognizes that, this is more than just you have competitive advantage, something like this is bad for everybody if should this sort of continue. And I don't see us getting to that point. I also want to say too, Darius, with regards to your outlook or 42 macros outlook on Japan inflation and all that and CPI, even if at this point, even if your models were showing them reaching above that 2% CPI mark in the next 12 months. And I'm saying 12 months because Governor Kuroda's tenure ends in 12 months. The whole policy is for it to sustain and maintain above that. So you can't just tap into, you know, above 2% once and then call it a day on yield curve control. And so there's not enough time even for them to ditch yield curve control based on those, you know, the metrics that they laid out or the qualifications they laid out for them to abandon, you know, their easing policy.
And this is why we spend so much time sort of helping investors understand and contextualizing the growth cycle separate and apart from the inflation cycle, separate and apart from the liquidity cycle, separate and apart from the positioning cycle, which is buy side sort of response to all three of those different cycles. They're all moving independently of each other, but they all sort of have reflexive impacts upon one another. And at the end of the day, you know, the Bank of Japan and the Ministry of Finance in Japan are first and foremost are going to be on the lookout for maintaining, you know, the house is in order in the Japanese economy. And right now, at least with respect to the inflation mandate, they're nowhere near achieving that objective. So we should not expect any material change in their policy mix. Rhetoric is rhetoric, but actions are actions.
We're going to take another quick break and be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Let's just go to questions, Darius. So this is from Oliver from the exchange. I'd love to know what this dynamic duo's take is. I don't know who the other duo is. On DXY and what effect it's having on markets. So I guess DXY has just broken through, another multi-year level today. Euro's getting destroyed. DXY is, you know, majority euro. But what's your take on that?
Yeah, so I mean, we track the BBDXY, the Bloomberg Dollar Index. It's a little bit more of a thoughtful basket in terms of, you know, accurately weighting the components in the basket relative to the trade flows across the various regions. And that's been making new highs for quite some time. You know, it's on a multi-year high. And so, when you think about the tightening of financial conditions we've seen thus far year to date, it's really been kind of through three main channels, really. It's been through a decline or sort of increase in dollar and in strong dollar. And then it's been through sort of a widening of credit spreads and an increase in interest rates. You know, up until this most recent kind of four or five trading days, you hadn't really seen a tightening of financial conditions materially in sort of equity valuations, equity risk premia. We're obviously starting to see that, but there's a lot of sort of space for that to play catch up to things like credit spreads, things like interest rates, mortgage rates, et cetera. I mean, I got a couple of charts I think are important to highlight. You know, we'll start with mortgage rates, Brian. If you pull that chart up with the blue line in the top panel shows the mortgage rate, the national mortgage rate as far back as we can get the data. The red line in the top panel just shows the NAHB housing market survey. Typically what you see, you know, when you have these big upside deviations in mortgage rates, the middle panel just shows the trailing three-year Z-score in terms of mortgage rates. And so right now, I think this is the biggest rise we've ever seen on the trailing three-year Z-score basis in mortgage rates. And historically, those kind of three sigma type moves have historically correlated to, kind of breakdowns in housing market activity. And we continue to get that through the data. But yesterday, we got new home sales down 13% year over year, pending home sales today down 8% year over year. The second chart I'd like to show and as relates to the tightening of financial conditions we've seen year to date is credit yields, Brian. Well, that chart where we show the Bloomberg corporate aggregate index of all both high yield and investment grade corporate credit outstanding in the U.S., and we're showing it on a yield to worst basis. And we're also showing that in this middle panel in terms of trailing three-year Z-score basis. And what you're seeing here is a near three sigma rise in credit yields and in the cost of credit for corporates in this country. And so historically, those three sigma type moves have coincided with big drawdowns in the ISM manufacturing PMI, which we know is highly correlated to, you know, risk asset returns, et cetera, et cetera. And so that's my, kind of my long-winded way of saying, hey, the financial condition we've already seen thus far, even though the Fed has only hiked interest rates 25 basis points on the Fed funds rate and has shrunk its balance sheet by all of $0 thus far, even though it's then the forward guidance function that's caused these moves in mortgage rates, that's caused these moves in credit yields, that's caused this move in the dollar, and that those moves are real. They will have a material impact on slowing the economy in the quarters ahead. And all the Fed is really doing at this point is really just confirming and corroborating what's already priced into money markets.
Yeah, and because Tim from the RV side actually asked about HYG, and you know it's plummeting. What I'll say about that too, and again tying it right back into BOJ, just pull up a chart of HYG and then throw a chart of put JPY USD, or you could do USD JPY inverted on top of it, and you might see partially what the answer is. What I'm basically saying is that the that lack of, you know, Japanese buyers of, they don't just buy treasuries, they buy credit, they buy like, you know, credit, they buy like horrible credit. They're in search of yield, and so if they're pulling back from those markets, or they're not deploying capital that normally would be otherwise, on sort of a seasonal basis, you know, Brian, if you actually pull up chart number one, you know, you'll see that. I'm sorry, chart number two, Brian. If Japanese investors are not deploying capital into the U.S. Treasury market as well as into, you know, U.S. Credit and European credit and all that, you're going to see sell-offs in things like HYG. Now, this chart that I have pulled up, this is just sort of a year-to-date of where we stand in terms of, you know, the events on the horizon, the events in the past. And you'll see basically that dollar yen and treasury yields just, you know, shoot upwards starting in March, going right into fiscal year end for Japan. And this point last year, at the same exact point, that was the reversal. April 1st was the reversal for the spike in U.S. treasury yields and the spike in U.S. Dollar yen as, you know, the fiscal year, like new fiscal year started, redeployment of capital, buying of treasuries and all that kind of stuff brought yields back down. This time it didn't happen because of the insanity and, you know, with the currency, as well as hedging costs that were taking out, you know, the yields for premium between the U.S. and Japan. But we are now upon, you know, Golden Week. We have one trading day left. We have a Bank Japan meeting at 12 noon in a few hours. And then after market close is the real meeting with, you know, BOJ Governor Kuroda. And that's, again, after market close. And then after that, Japan is out off the grid for the next, you call it six trading days, or, you know, 11 days, you know, the total. And so there's going to be very interesting sort of things that could potentially happen. My view is that they're not going to actually change anything, but they're probably going to announce a policy review for the next meeting, for the next BOJ meeting. And that gives them sort of flexibility to do something or not, but markets are probably going to take that, as a widening out of the band.
If they announce a policy review, that's going to be carnage in the bond market globally.
Very well could be. The other thing too is that you know, you might see some stability in the. So I'm also suspecting that currently, this past week at least, and we're gonna get this data in a few hours as well before Japan market open. But I think that you're gonna see Japan actually started to deploy their capital overseas this past week. So you're probably going to see foreign bond investing out of Japan like drastically tick up for this week. And that's why you see that recorrelation of dollar yen and treasury yields as well. We'll see about that. But yeah, Derek's absolutely right. If they don't even have to do anything, they just need to hint at policy review, the markets will take that as, okay, they're going to widen out this band to, I don't know, 50 totally. Basis points, whatever it is. It'll be a rate hike sort of equivalent absolutely. In terms of market sort of reaction. And that's going to be absent Japan's reaction too. Keep that in mind. Whatever happens or doesn't happen in markets, that's not the full reaction. That is the reaction absent the actual Japanese investors' reaction because of Golden Week. Darius, do you have any last words before we head into BOJ, the first meaningful BOJ meeting in years?
Yeah, cash is king.
Yen? Like, define cash.
Define cash. Preferably dollar-based cash or tether-based cash for my crypto friends out there, but I think we can all figure it out what to do with that statement.
Yeah, cash is king unless you're based where I am, in which case it's not.
It's cash is trash. You are
exactly. That's why I'm saying define it. You can't just say you can't just blindly throw out this is a general term cash. Cash is a very different
thing. Buy some Japanese stocks, man.
Or pay my heating bill. Anyway, so anyway, thanks for watching the Real Vision Daily Briefing. I'll do an update on Twitter and all that. Make sure you're following Darius as well, for BOJ updates. Ash Bankton will be back tomorrow with Peter Bukvar. In the meantime, check out Real Vision's newest podcast, The Next Big Trade, with Harry Melandri. So Harry will talk to some of the world's, foremost traders about, like, current trends in markets and what they believe is a smart bet. All right, so enjoy. And thanks a lot, Darius.
Thank you.
Welcome to The Next Big Trade. On this program, I'll talk to some of the world's foremost traders about current trends in markets and what they believe is a smart bet.
My next big trade is Tesla, and Tesla being the king of the climate change impactful companies that an investor can invest in and think about over the next decade what they will hopefully accomplish will be monumental and probably even be bigger than what Apple has accomplished.
Yeah, my forecasts are not going to change whether the Green Deal gets approved or doesn't get approved. If you don't have a planet, you won't care who invades who. It's completely irrelevant.
The bond market has two jobs. It's all they need to do is future inflation and future growth. That's it. So when you've only got two variables to look at, you're most likely that the outcome of the hive mind of bond investors are going to reach the right kind of consensus. I've only seen consensus wrong once in my entire career, and that was 1994, when the bond market blew up. Other than that, the bond consensus has always been right.
What's up, revolutionaries? Thanks for tuning in to the Real Vision Daily Briefing. For more content like this, head over to realvision.com and get unfiltered access to the very best, brightest, and biggest names in finance.